I'm Jimmy Apple, the EMS Avenger. This is the EMS Avenger podcast, and I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Jeff Jarvis, who is pretty well known in the EMS circles and evidence-based medicine circles and emergency medicine circles, somebody who has certainly affected your practice if you practice delayed sequence intubation, somebody who has a podcast of his own, the EMS Lighthouse Project, one of my favorite podcasts. Somebody who is influential in the world of cardiac arrest and an esteemed medical director. And today we're going to be talking about epinephrine, bicarb, and Narcan. Oh my. So we're just going to tee right off into epinephrine. And Dr. Jarvis, I have this theory that the American Heart Association hates dogs. And the reason why I have this theory is because over a century ago, we put some pups into a lethal dysrhythmia, and we gave them absurd amounts of epinephrine and saw some rhythm changes. Those dogs, unfortunately, were no longer with us following that. But since then, that's basically the best evidence that we've had for epinephrine and cardiac arrest, and I think it's because the AHA hates dogs. And it's only in the last 5 years that we're actually starting to see some quality evidence on epinephrine, and it's not looking very good for epinephrine. So I'm going to serve it up to you there, and we can just keep it going.
So first off, thank you for having me on your podcast. Great podcast. Man, I'm just constantly jealous of your voice. You do so well at this job. Great podcast. Thank you for having me on. And thank you for teeing up one of my favorite topics. So the paper you're talking about is by Krill and Dooley in 1906. And it was about asphyxiation in mongrel dogs. Mongrel means, by the way, after reading that paper, mongrel means anybody's dogs but your own. They would go out and damn near, if it wasn't on a leash, they would take it, and they strangled these poor pups and then gave them epinephrine. So me and my golden doodles are going to go find their gravestone somewhere and pee on their graves.
Transcend to mongrel patients, like I'm going to give epinephrine to anybody's mother but my own.
I would hope not. I would definitely hope not. So your point on this, I think, is absolutely true. It worked then. So we went through a long period where we just accepted it as gospel. It was in ACLS, therefore that's it. The Heart Association said it. That's it. And we started in the 80s. I went to a paramedic school in 1987, graduated in 88, and right around that time, we started doing some actual prospective, well-done, randomized control trials with epinephrine. But we didn't do the study we needed, which was epi versus nothing versus placebo. We did epi versus more epi. And there were multiple versions of more epi. Escalating doses are all the epi all the time. And basically what we found is that if you gave a table enough epinephrine, you would get pulses back on that table. But it was still a table, right? You didn't spontaneously turn the table into Einstein. And it just wasn't what we were looking for. We were looking for functional neurologic survival, the thing patients care about, not ROSC. More epinephrine equals more ROSC. There's never been a doubt about that. Literature's crystal clear. Your listeners may recognize, hey, you know what? I'm not giving 5 milligrams of epinephrine every 3 to 5 minutes. I'm not giving 1 milligram of epi, then 3 milligrams, then 5 milligrams. Those trials showed more epinephrine was not the answer. I wasn't involved, but science tried to do a really well-done randomized placebo-controlled trial in Australia to answer this question. And unfortunately, because this has become so dogmatic, medics refused to participate in the study because they said withholding epinephrine was unethical. Eventually, they did it just in the Perth area, and they showed higher ROSC, but no difference in neurologic survival.
So that catches us up to the groundbreaking Paramedic 2 trial.
Yeah.
And the Paramedic 2 trial was really no surprise to anyone that really is immersed in that world where there was increased rates of ROSC, But that doesn't mean that any of those people could do a crossword puzzle or recognize family right. members or bathe themselves or wipe their own behinds. And that is the goal in resuscitation and cardiac arrest, is we want a functioning person back. And since then, we've gotten a lot of different data points, not necessarily anything that sounds the death knell for epinephrine, but we have studies that show that maybe one targeted epinephrine very early on may have a benefit. We have studies that show actually this landmark paper from Salt Lake City, Utah, that shows increased survival for that department with intramuscular administration of epinephrine. We have some services out there that are doing epinephrine drips or that have had their dose. Unfortunately, COVID has borked a lot of the data that people were collecting on that. But
it's a good word.
Yeah. So Paramedic 2, I don't know if necessarily answered any questions as much as it is produced a whole lot more.
So I think the beautiful thing, so Dr. Perkins did an amazing job with this study. Just to catch all of your listeners up, well done, large randomized control trial in the UK of, I believe it's 10 to 11 NHS ambulance trust, which is some massive population of the UK. And what they did was they randomized patients to either get placebo or epi the way we're giving it now. And what they found, their primary outcome was 30-day survival. And they found a 0.8% increase in 30-day survival in the group that got epinephrine. Now, they also looked at functional neurologic survival, and what they found is there was no difference in functional neurologic survival. Okay, all well and good. That's basically what we would have predicted. But if it were just that, I think it's more or less a negative trial, but not huge. But this was a really well done trial, and it was well written. And I really encourage people to go read the discussion. So they said, let's take a look at the MRS scores, the modified Rankin scores, how functional people are if they survive or in the trial of both arms. Now, the vast majority of both arms died. So that's the big group. But then they looked at those. If you look at just survivors, and you look at the proportion that have neurologic devastation, Jimmy, bad, yeah. bad things.
Right.
Almost
means
double
that person
the rate.
Isn't grateful to be alive.
No, absolutely. They're not aware. Right. So they literally cannot do, they can't bathe, they can't wipe their own butts. Peg traked in a nursing home is no way to live. And I'll get back to what patients want, but what they found, almost double the rate of neurologic devastation among survivors. So that is the part that really got my attention. Now, you mentioned that's not what we're trying to do. So other research has gone out and they've talked to people, actual patients, and they said, what do you value? What is the minimum clinically important difference in survival? How much improved survival? Is it worth it for you to take a risk of neurologic devastation? What they said was somewhere between 2 and 3%. So if there is 3 to 5% improved survival, it's worth the risk of neurologic devastation. 0.8%, what we saw here, is well below that. This is not what patients want.
No. Well, the question is now, and we also, not to take too much thunder away from an upcoming podcast for you, we theorized, well, what if we give it IO? Because we've had some studies that say survival is lower with IO than it is IV, but we know that those studies weren't informative. They weren't designed to come to that conclusion, and we assumed that those patients were just sicker cohorts. We also know from some data that we can get epinephrine to central circulation significantly faster from time of EMS arrival to time to central circulation with intraosseous administration of epinephrine. So we had this Paramedic 3 trial that just came out and showed that there was no difference, which probably goes to show that what we kind of suspect, which is the medications that we're giving overall probably don't impact survival very much.
But so yeah, that's definitely one conclusion. And ultimately, I think that's probably the right conclusion. Initially, the evidence about IV and IO came from the ALPS trial, the amiodarone lidocaine placebo trial. And this was obviously in shockable rhythms. And what they found is no difference in survival with amiodarone or lidocaine compared to placebo. But they did a secondary analysis, still randomized controlled trial, but they went back, did a secondary analysis and said, well, let's look only at those patients who got the drug by IV. And there was improved functional survival with amiodarone. No difference with IO. Maybe the route matters. So a lot of people had done some work. I had a paper, Tanner Smita, this amazing young
does great
student
work.
Doctor.
Yeah.
He really does. He's annoying because he's so nice and so smart and such a good writer. So we, of course, have to hate him. He did this great paper and was nice enough to let me on. And it looked like at all cardiac arrest and the initial IO, and we were looking at humeral head versus lower extremity, and we saw better survival with humeral head. Well, maybe there's something to that. Other studies have shown better survival regardless of drug with IV. Interestingly, the paramedic group that did the all caps paramedic, meaning the study group, they went and looked at that with the paramedic 2 data and didn't see an impact. They really said this is way more an issue about how quickly you give the drug than the route that you give the drug. The paramedic 3 study that you're talking about, randomized control trial, IV versus IO, no difference. And there were 2 other randomized control trials, essentially the same question, essentially the same finding. I don't think it's a function of IV versus IO.
So where are we now? Like, so if you were to build a team right now and said,
yeah,
I am going to go out there and design the most evidence-based approach to epinephrine administration and cardiac arrest, where would we be?
So I think we have to take a look at the limitations of paramedic 2. And there is a massive one out there knocking on the door, and that is time from arrest to first epinephrine. So they measured it in paramedic 2, and it was 21 minutes.
Yep.
Now, to be clear, that's not 21 minutes from arrival to the drug. It's from 911 or whatever their 999, whatever their version is. So it includes response time.
Yeah. That's still significant, though. I mean, if you're in a large metropolitan area, that's an eternity.
Yeah. And we looked at – I did some stuff with ESO data, and it turns out in the United States across the all ESO customers, like 3,600 of them, turns out the time is somewhere around 16, 17 minutes faster, but I'm not sure it makes a difference. There is literature that says the faster you get the epinephrine, the higher their survival. But they're talking within 10 minutes of arrest versus after 10 minutes. So let's just take this concept that at least the first dose of epinephrine matters, probably matters more in non-shockable rhythms than shockable, probably. We don't know because we haven't specifically looked. And let's just say there is an intervention out there. There is some way that we can get the drug into the patient faster than we can right now. Maybe that makes a difference. And that's what you meant by Dr. Youngquist and his colleagues in Salt Lake City.
And let me just mention, too, the non-shockable rhythms. I actually had Dr. Antevi on, and I haven't actually published this episode yet, but we talked about his approach in Palm Beach County where they don't administer epinephrine in shockable rhythms.
You know, it's – boy, the literature's all over the place. And Peter and I have exactly the same amount of evidence to support our practices, by the way. There was a Japanese registry study that looked at early epinephrine versus no epinephrine. Huge limitations, the biggest of which is we're not Japan. Their system is a little different than ours. But it actually showed improved survival, even in shockable rhythms, if you get it there quickly. I definitely think that if you're going to give it early and then probably limit it. So the way I've interpreted the data is we give 1 milligram of epinephrine as soon as we can through an IV or IO. Foreshadowing, we'll come back to that. And then if it's shockable, no more epi. If it's not shockable, we hang an epi infusion. And the infusion is geared toward getting about 3 milligrams total across about a 20 to 30 minute
Okay.
code. I would love to point to an RCT that says doing it this way is the thing to do. I can't. And before anybody out there says, well, Jarvis, you're just out there experimenting on patients, we all practice medicine that has not had an RCT. So if we only practice medicine after you had multiple RCTs, we would not practice medicine because most of what we do hasn't been practiced, hasn't been shown in an RCT to work. A lot of them would be unethical to do. I think this about blood, as a matter of fact. I think it's unethical to do a randomized controlled placebo controlled study with blood. There's
Sure.
no doubt if your hemoglobin is 2 and your last red blood cell is on the pavement, you need more blood. If you have the ability to give it, I think it's unethical not to. The challenge is, does it make a difference if you don't have it available? And that's the challenges with the blood study. So that you brought up Salt Lake City, and I really want to hit on that because I think
Yeah,
it's
that's where I was bringing you to right
so
now.
important. So, Jimmy, when you were in paramedic school, you probably learned the same thing that I did when I was in paramedic school, and that is that IM injections do not work in low perfusion states.
Right.
So if you give an
And that's the
injection,
reason why we switched from I sub-Q epi to IM epi and anaphylaxis.
right. In anaphylaxis, and that's not cardiac arrest from anaphylaxis,
Right.
that's anaphylaxis. So presumably they still have a pulse, but it's low.
Right.
And it seems to work in that population. As a matter of fact, it seems to work really well in that population. But despite that, we have this notion that you give IM injection epi and it just sits there until your blood pressure comes up. So when I heard what Dr. Youngquist was doing in Salt Lake City, he ran an experiment where they would show up on scene. One of their medics would go in. They have at least 8 to 10 people in every cardiac arrest, so they have the resources to do this. They would establish PICC crew CPR, ventilations, defibrillation, the things. One person would be doing an IO or an IV while their other medic just walked up and hit them with 5 milligrams of epinephrine in the lateral thigh, IM injection in cardiac arrest. And initially they just said, does that get the epi in faster? Yes. I think we all know we can get the injection in faster than the IV or IO. The really cool paper he just did is a before after paper in that study, and what he showed is improved survival. Specifically, there was about in all comers, so shockable, non-shockable, about a 4% improved survival in the IM epi group. That was an odds ratio adjusted for all the things of 1.95, and what that means is 95% higher odds of survival in this study with IM epi. Now, presumably, it's because they got it in 3 minutes faster. So I run a tiered system like a lot of people do. And that means my engine companies get on scene substantially faster than the ambulance. And all of our EMTs on engines can give IM epi for anaphylaxis. What would happen if they were giving IM epi in cardiac arrest? 6, 8 minutes faster than the ambulance. We don't know because it hadn't been done, but it sure is an intriguing thought. And I think if epinephrine is going to work, that's probably how.
That's a question that's something that people have been talking about a lot. And I remember actually instigating a discussion on Twitter, which I think you might have contributed to, where I talked about survival rates being higher with BLS crews and whether or not they should be given IM epinephrine. And then it was whether or not they should be transporting or not. It was a whole big thing. But I think
So
that that
wait,
is.
let me just confirm here. I want to give you a chance to correct the blasphemy that
Did
you
I
just
just say,
said.
what did I say?
Surely you're not suggesting that conversations on Twitter can deteriorate into things that you didn't initially mean in your initial post. Surely
believe
you would
it
never
or
say
not,
that.
Believe it or not, people will hijack a conversation online to serve their own agenda.
Perhaps this is a good plug for an upstart social media platform.
Follow us on Blue Sky.
There you go.
So I think that that is probably a game changer, is the BLS crew with IMEPI.
Yeah.
Is there research now? Is I'm assuming that Salt Lake City paper is going to be impetus for research on this.
Yeah, Dr. Youngquist is working right now on an RCT. So Great. To be clear, that was one study in a Salt Lake City's big. They do a lot of cardiac arrests, but not that big, right? It's not the entire nation. And he'll be the first to tell you that we really need to prove this. And this is promising. And it is enough, hopefully, to get us over the IRB hurdle of doing an RCT. And you wouldn't do a placebo-controlled. You would probably do IMEPI in one. So on odd days, even days, different stations, however you randomize it, you're still sending the same resources. In your intervention group, your EMTs are giving IM injections of epinephrine. In your control group, they're not. And you still, you know, EMS gets there and starts the IV and then gives the epi. That, I think, especially if he can do it in multiple centers, hint, Scott, if you're listening, I'd be more than happy to participate here in Fort Worth. I think that could, an RCT that looks at that, well done with significant results, I think would be a clear game changer.
All right. We're going to switch gears now. And we're going to talk about sodium bicarbonate and cardiac arrest. And at this point, we all know that when you administer that buffer to someone in cardiac arrest, it doesn't exactly do what people think it does. I think that kind of your average boots on the ground think that what happens is that you administer bicarb and it just collects all that acid and just protects it in a lockbox and doesn't allow it to affect the rest of the body. And what we're desperately trying to communicate to people is that that bicarb absorbs that acid, becomes carbonic acid, which does not like being carbonic acid. It hates being carbonic acid. Those chemicals don't get along. And so it makes a couple of rounds through circulation, gets to the lungs, and they get a divorce right there. And suddenly creates the CO2 acid burden on the body that can't be relieved because we're using protective ventilation strategies. And so it's essentially an acid grenade.
That was a euphemism, my friend. I love it. Protective ventilation. I'll just be clear. You're trying to be nice. We suck at ventilations, y'all.
Sure. Well, but
very nice way of saying
even
that.
Using the ventilation that we would use in high performance CPR, we're not creating the minute ventilation to relieve that acid burden. So that means no bicarb in any cardiac arrest ever, right?
You know, so this is fascinating because neither of us are particularly young. We went to paramedic school a long time ago, and man, bicarb was the thing. We know that in cardiac arrest, you're going to be acidotic. Therefore, give bicarb. It'll fix it. You very correctly pointed out giving bicarb does not change your pH at all until you get rid of the CO2 with ventilations. I love your carbonic acid description. It's absolutely right. So you got to blow it off. You give bicarb. There is no doubt. And there was recently a really nice study that quantified this. I don't remember the number, but you give bicarb and look at the end tidal. The end tidal is going to spike. So we have been trained to think a spike in end tidal means pulses. And by all means, if you see a spike in end tidal, look for pulses. But if you don't find it, it's probably because it's not there. Mm-hmm. So bicarb will see higher end tidal CO2. No doubt about it. It's probably from the bicarb. Last about 10 minutes and then it's gone. So we gave bicarb up front, massive doses, and then some evidence came out that says no difference in survival. Stop doing it. And then the practice changed to, we're going to do it for metabolic acidosis after we've done all the other things. And so when people would actually give bicarb is when they're well into the kitchen sink phase of a cardiac arrest. Like, well, what else is there to give? I don't know. Grind the kitchen sink up, give that crap. Let's see if that does something. So if you look at the evidence on it, the way studies are typically done is they look at a big set of data, the ESO data set, the ImageTrend data set, the NEMSIS data set, and they say, we're going to take all cardiac arrests and split them into two groups. Those who got bicarb and those who didn't, and we're going to compare survival. Survival in the bicarb group sucked. It was way less than the non-bicarb. Bicarb must be killing patients. Now, the interesting thing is studies have been done comparing mask ventilation and cardiac arrest to endotracheal intubation using the same methodology. We're just going to take the group, the ones who got mask ventilation go over here, the ones who got intubated go over here. Every single study shows much better survival in the BVM group.
Sure,
than in
the PART trial and the
PART and Airways 2 were, those were actually randomized control trials. So these were just retrospective studies. And BVM always outdid intubation.
Right.
So Jimmy, when you are at the gym, because clearly you work out, you're at the gym and you look great. Obviously you work out. You're at the gym, you're on a treadmill, and there's a 45-year-old guy who clearly has not seen a treadmill in 30 years. It's January 1st. He's hitting the gym. He starts clutching his chest. He drops to the ground in cardiac arrest. You get off. You start CPR, and AED shows up like 30 seconds later, says, shock advised, you zap him. He says, ouch, do you mind if I finish my workout? That is the person most likely to survive. You don't have time to intubate him before he got pulses back. So there's a selection bias. And the selection bias is really important. And I think we might have a topic up here in a second where selection bias is really important. So when you actually randomize them, it turns out probably no difference. When it comes to bicarb, we're not really randomizing them. We're doing these observational studies, and selection bias and time bias is a huge issue. A guy named or a woman named Niederberger and Dr. Meningozzi, who is the founding editor-in-chief of PEC, great researcher, they did a time-dependent, time-based propensity analysis. So they basically did that same observational study using ESO data, but they controlled for time. So two groups, no bicarb, bicarb, but they controlled for time. And what they saw is improved survival. Specifically, there was 30% improved odds of functional neurologic survival in all patients who got bicarb once you adjusted it for time. Now, that survival, turns out you didn't see a survival advantage in shockable rhythms, but you did in a systole and PEA. So if the moral of the story, the way I interpret the literature, and again, no randomized control trial on this, but if you're going to give bicarb, give it in the non-shockables and do it early. Probably that, not before epi, but pretty quickly thereafter.
I see a common thread there where your asystole, your non-shockable rhythms, asystole and PEA, seem to be the most pharmacologically dependent conditions in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, whereas somebody in a shockable rhythm, it's really about just effectively getting your defibrillations in as quick as possible.
Absolutely. You nailed it.
So does that mean that your service is giving bicarb early in non-shockable rhythms?
Can we talk quality improvement for a second here? just between you and me.
Absolutely.
Nobody else is
no
here.
One else
just,
is listening.
Just between friends. This is the fascinating thing. We did not give bicarb in cardiac arrest. We gave it in TCAs. We gave it for our hyperkalemias along with calcium. So we had a little time, and we would draw up the bicarb because the vials were cheaper than the Johnny and Roy Pop-a-Top Abajet prefilled syringes, right? The Bristol Jets. So then I said, we're going to implement based on this study. We're going to
Wait,
implement.
you're taking our Johnny and Roy away from us? Why don't you
No, I
just
want to
take
bring
away
Johnny
lights
and
and
Roy
sirens
back.
from us?
That's a different podcast. No, I'm trying to bring Johnny and Roy back to EMS. We had vials. So I wrote the protocol and said, in non-shockables, get your first dose of Epi and then flush the line and then give bicarb. And what I found is it was taking us a really long time to give bicarb. So we did our drug. We went and we looked, and I'm like, why the hell is it taking so long? Well, because they're mucking around drawing it up. So we're like, aha, this is important. Put the Bristojets back on the trucks. And now our time to bicarb has dropped, shockingly. So yeah, we did it. We haven't been doing it long enough to really, well, we made other changes too, I might add. We did the Epi, we did dual sequential defibrillation, we delayed implementation of mechanical chest compressions for the first 10 minutes. We really focused on doing PICC crew CPR, all the things that we know work. And we've certainly seen our survival go up. I don't know if it was from the bicarb or the changes in Epi or maybe just better coordination. I don't know.
You
But
know,
yeah, we implemented it.
we're going to have to do a podcast now on dual sequential defibrillation, and the European paper that just came out that really tried to nail down how often are you actually seeing real refractory VFib. And
You
then
know,
that leads to the DOSE-VF trial actually playing fast and loose with the definition of refractory VF.
I saw the paper, and there was a secondary analysis of dose to VF trying to get to the same thing. I don't think it's fast and loose. I think it's the difference between a pragmatic trial and an absolutely strict research trial where you're trying to understand. With a pragmatic trial, you're trying to know which works better. So here you are, Jimmy. There you are in the field. And you have a patient in VFib. Zap, you shock them, CPR. Zap, you shock them, CPR. Zap, you shock them, CPR. They're still in fib. You got to do something. You don't know what the rhythm was under the compressions because you can't
Correct.
see it. And let's just monitor agnostic. Let's just pretend you don't know. You have a decision to make, shock or not shock. And dose to VF did that. After three shocks, you either do vector change, regular defibrillation, or dual sequence. I don't care whether they converted and went back into it. What I know is they're in a shockable rhythm now. They did the two things versus the one thing and had better survival. I think that is a pragmatic trial using the information we have in front of us.
Sure.
Does it really matter? I don't know, but I got to go based on what I'm seeing now.
Sure, I'm seeing
Now,
with
you
my
could,
own
if you
eyes
want
that
to
this is
go
doing
after,
something.
absolutely. If you want to go after dose VF for being underpowered and prematurely terminated because of COVID, I get it. I think that's legitimate.
Sure.
Who knows what is underlying the rhythm until we have the technology to do something about it. I mean, what are we going to do with this information? Yeah, the first defibrillation actually converted them. We don't know about it. Sorry, man. I had a rollover medical control call there.
Okay.
So you might want to edit that part out. My bad. If they actually are getting converted with that first defibrillation and you're doing 2 minutes of CPR, and by the time you look again, they're in VFib, did they go back into the VFib or did they actually stay in VFib? Unless we have the technology to see, or we're going to go back to prolonged pauses with stacked shocks, probably doesn't make a difference.
Why do you think that paper was so pointedly directed at the VF trial, though, in their discussion?
So I want to be clear, I've only read the abstract on that paper. So I don't I let me withhold judgment until I fully analyze it, and I'll give you my answer on my podcast. How about that?
Okay. We're going to bring it home now with the last thing we're going to talk about, which is Narcan in cardiac arrest. And man, if you want to separate the sheep from the goats on social media,
Oh my God.
just toss a Narcan grenade into an evidence-based discussion and cardiac arrest. And you will get people who get big mad one way or the other.
Absolutely. I was one of them.
Okay. So
yeah,
I am agnostic. Just tell me what the data says and I will do it.
Okay. You ready for the answer?
Not yet.
Oh, yes, I was going to say, yeah.
Let's not bury the lead. Go ahead.
You should stay agnostic.
Okay.
There you go. Stay agnostic.
Okay. We actually haven't had great data on Narcan and cardiac arrest. What we have are
Probably no data.
No data is not good data. We have a lot of smart people who have kind of come together and said, what could Narcan possibly be doing in cardiac arrest?
Right.
Even though the AHA is, you know, kind of like muddies the waters and says, it might be cardioprotective. But in reality, we've had no evidence that Narcan does a thing to somebody in cardiac arrest. It certainly isn't going to make a patient start breathing again if their heart isn't beating, and it's not going to get their heart started again. We had a paper that came out a little while ago that showed that in populations that received Narcan that were supposedly in cardiac arrest before EMS got there had higher survival rates. But we had this. We had this, and who knows who was giving that?
Judgy.
We had this paper that came out not too long ago, a California paper that was performed by several counties, where Narcan was given to patients by EMS who were in cardiac arrest of suspected opioid overdose. About 9,000 patients, and what they found was that survival to discharge was higher in the Narcan cohort, and the number needed to treat was, I believe, 9. And this was a paper that everybody was like, WTF, man. So what's the deal?
Well, that was exactly what I said after reading that. I'm like, seriously? What the? So it is really an interesting thing. I was very much on team do not give Narcan in cardiac arrest. My thinking was once you have established ventilations, people die in narcotic overdose because of apnea and hypoxia and hypercapnia, not anything else. And once you're dealing with that, the benefit of the Narcan is they breathe on their own. Once they're in cardiac arrest, horses left the barn. No potential mechanism. So stop doing it. You're wasting time. Yeah, so I may have been wrong. There was this California paper. There was a similar paper from Portlandia in the Portland area. Similar methods, the stats they used, they did not leave a stat unturned. They used all the math they could. And the reason that they had to throw so much math at this problem is because of indication bias. So both studies were observational. So they didn't do, this was not really an experiment. It just wasn't an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
What they noticed is that their medics were giving some patients Narcan in cardiac arrest and not giving other patients Narcan. So they said, well, let's see if it's doing any difference. So they compared, this may sound familiar to our bicarb discussion, they looked at all of their cardiac arrest and split them up into those who got Narcan and those who didn't. And those who got Narcan survived at a much higher rate. So Jimmy, riddle me this.
Well, here's the curveball, is that patients who ultimately did not have an opioid-related arrest also had higher survival.
Well, the challenge
according to the paper.
Well, and I'm not saying that both of these papers exceedingly well done.
Sure.
So this is not a criticism of the paper, and I'm not saying anything the authors didn't say. But what they used was the data that said suspected opioid overdose. So there were some patients who got Narcan, and the medic did not indicate suspected overdose. Jimmy, why are you going to give Narcan to anybody?
Because I suspect it's been an opioid overdose.
Right? Have you ever in all of the charts that you've done in your life, missed a box that maybe you were supposed to check that you didn't.
Absolutely. Yes.
So if you didn't suspect...
But if my employer is listening, of course not.
Of course not. Yeah, right. No. Right. Just human nature. All of us do this. We try really hard not to, but sometimes it happens. All data... This is my mantra as a researcher. All data is dirty data. So they have a population of patients who got Narcan, but the chart said... Well, it didn't say that narcotic overdose was not suspected. It just
I need
didn't
you to start a garage band
was.
Called Dirty Data.
Wouldn't that be a great one?
Yeah.
Man, I got some people for lead singer right now. So the challenge here is that this indication bias means that fundamentally the group that Narcan and the group that did not get Narcan are two fundamentally different populations. And there is one piece of data from table one, the one that describes the characteristics, that really highlights this. The group that got the Narcan, the median age was 35. Hmm. The group that did not get it, the median age was 64. If all I tell you, you have two cardiac arrests, one's 35, one's 64. If you were a betting man, who would you say was going to survive?
The 31-year-old.
Probably the 35-year-old, right?
Yeah.
So no amount of math in the world can control for that difference.
Sure.
So these two things are hypothesis generating. Maybe it's doing something, and there are some potential mechanisms. Dr. Dave Wampler wrote an editorial in the journal that I think the Portland paper was published in, maybe the California paper. Dave Wampler is a paramedic at UT Health Science Center, San Antonio. He's also a PhD biochemist, and he said, well, here are some of the potential mechanisms, and probably not worth going into, but there are some plausible mechanisms. Bottom line, stay agnostic, my friend. We just don't know the answer to this. This, you got to have an RCT on.
So the only rationale, there are times where I have administered Narcan a cardiac arrest, and it's because of my own observational, which is obviously very low on the hierarchy of evidence. But I was consistently seeing patients who were in PEA being given Narcan and just, you know, magically experiencing ROSC within a minute. And talking to one of the chief of over EMS locally, you probably know Nick Adams mm-hmm. with Cobb
yeah.
Fire. He said, I have the data to show you how much pseudo arrest we're calling cardiac arrest. And giving Narcan is really just reversing respiratory arrest. Because we just kind of suck sometimes at checking a pulse. So that's really the only time that I feel that I will approach cardiac arrest with Narcan and say, this may be reasonable, but of course it's still patient dependent. Like if I have someone who is, you know, 70 years old and doesn't, you know,
in a systole.
Yeah. In a systole. And, you know, there's a story there that says this person is certainly not in respiratory arrest from
right.
narcotics overdose. That's one thing. I have a 31-year-old who's in PEA arrest in a one room hotel room. I think that Narcan is probably a pretty reasonable approach there.
So 8 months ago, I would have said, Jimmy, you ignorant slut. There is no potential way that can work. Jeff of November 21st, 2024 says, maybe it's reasonable. I think we just don't know. There was recently a third study on this that showed no difference. Subject to all of the same flaws. We just don't know. The situation you described, the plausibility here is that, and I don't know why this didn't occur to me. I grew up in an age where I gave lots of morphine. We didn't really give fentanyl. And morphine causes histamine release, and histamine causes vasodilation and can drop
Correct.
Your blood pressure. Why that very commonly known thing to me didn't suggest if you have an opioid overdose, maybe you have vasodilation, and maybe that beautiful ECG activity is actually corresponding with mechanical activity, and they're just really hypotensive.
What if there's data Narcan, out there that suggests that up to 40% of PEA is actually that?
Could be. Yeah. The pseudo-PEA, I terminate a lot of cardiac arrest. We do about 1,200 cardiac arrests a year, and somewhere around 50 to 60% of those end up getting terminated in the field. I lose the systole, sleep like a baby. It's sad. I'm sorry it happened, but there's no doubt about the outcome.
Sure.
Pseudo-PEA keeps me, or PEA, particularly fast narrow complex, keeps me awake at night. We just, without ultrasound, which we're working really hard to get ultrasound quickly, without ultrasound, it is just tough to tell the difference.
I've received orders to terminate PEA, and I'm just, I am like you. I just don't like it. I do not like terminating PEA, in the field anyway.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I'll do it because ultimately futile is futile, but man, it's not straightforward. So I don't want to just do a complete sidetrack on how I deal with terminating PEA.
I think it's an important conversation, so let's do it.
All right, well, there is a huge difference in a PEA at a rate of 30 with a QRS complex that takes up the entire screen and a QRS complex that's nice, narrow, hell, has P waves at 110. Those are fundamentally different rhythms.
Yeah.
The fast narrow is way more likely to be pseudo-PEA than what is essentially an agonal rhythm, the EMD
rhythm. One is a last gasp. The other, well, they're kind of both last gasps, but one is like, I'm really fighting to survive here. And the other is I'm just like, I've given up. Yeah.
So my approach to doing, I'm going to be way more aggressive with that second one, the fast narrow. I will take a look at end titles, obviously traumatic versus medical, huge difference, completely difference in the way I approach it. But in the medical patients at say 30 minutes or so, you've done everything you can think to do. They're still in this rhythm. And then I'll take a look at the end-tidal CO2. And let's say the end-tidal CO2 is 50. I want to know what the trend was. Well, what was it after you put in the airway? And let's say it was 50, and after 30 minutes, it's still 50. So no great changes. Everything about this case says it is futile. I just want a little bit more assurance. And this is what my friend Dr. Manifold taught me how to do, Craig Manifold. So he said, go, and I'm not telling anybody to do this. Please, God, don't do this.
Follow your local protocols, folks.
Absolutely. I really think this is something that really you should only do with medical control. I will do it because I've already made the determination that I'm going to terminate the arrest, right? So what I will do to help me confirm that is I'll hold compressions and continue ventilating. So the idea is that end-tidal CO2 is probably because there's some metabolism going on, but it could just as easily be because we're doing really good compressions. So if we hold the compressions, we take out that explanation. And if it is truly pseudo-PEA, we would anticipate that the end-tidal stays the same. What I'll tell you is almost always the entitle just goes thump. Mm-hmm. It plummets. And now I know, or I feel way more confident that there is no underlying metabolism going on. And I sleep better. Not quite as well as if I were looking at an ultrasound, but a whole lot better.
Right.
So please, God, don't do that. Talk to your medical director about it.
That's doctor shit, folks.
That is, it is, that's how I sleep better at night. There's clearly some legal issues in there, and I want to be very cautious about state protocols in those 49 lesser states that have to worry about that, unlike Texas. So well, it's a challenge.
Well, Doc, I think that we've covered those three subjects pretty well, and I hope that was informative to the provider out there. If not for their practice, at least just for a knowledge base, there's a lot of people who are very resistant to hearing, and it isn't just for the provider who isn't well informed. I talk about epinephrine a lot, and there are a lot of people who are shocked to find out that there's this concept of not giving epinephrine according to the AHA. But then there was also the people who are very staunchly and dogmatic against something like bicarb. Like, no bicarb, never, the evidence is against it, who also may not have considered that there's some subtlety and some variance to it. So I think that this actually speaks very well to both of these groups. I really appreciate
it. Can I give one final comment here about
absolutely.
That? Absolutely. I think the best way to approach this is to avoid dogma. There's this concept about Bayesian analysis, which is you come up with an idea about whether something is true or not, and then you get some additional evidence, and what, whether it's from a trial or whatever it is. And once you've gotten that additional evidence, you adjust your priors. And now you take that new evidence into effect and you remake your decision. Far too many of us skip that altogether. We just drop anchor on our priors, and we don't let additional evidence change our mind, change our posteriors. So I think the safest thing to do about medicine and about science in general is remain agnostic and be open to additional evidence. Now, maybe the evidence sways you, maybe it doesn't, but you got to be open to it. And I
absolutely
say that as somebody, like all humans, I drop anchor. Boy, did I drop anchor on don't give Narcan and cardiac arrest. Oopsie. There's a lot more egg on your face if you go all in on something that then turns out to be wrong. So keep
absolutely
an open mind about it.
Well, I hope the next time I see you, it is with a bourbon in hand.
That would be wonderful.
All right. Thanks a lot, Doc.
Hey, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun talking to you. And I do have to say, I see that Fleetwood Mac Rumors album over your right shoulder there. Love me some Fleetwood Mac.
Awesome. Take care.
Take care, buddy.
That was perfect. That was perfect.
Awesome. That was fun.
So little
enjoyed
editing
the conversation.
Involved in that. Yeah, me too. And I just got a text from my girlfriend who is starving. So as much as I would love to chat a little bit, we're going to end it.
It's funny. My family's telling me the same thing. Man, it was great talking to you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks.
See you, buddy.
All right. Bye.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Hold on. Don't hang up yet.